I'd like to introduce our speaker for tonight, Robert S. from Santee. Welcome, Robert.
I'm a little tall, so I got to kind of adjust this here. How's everybody doing? My name is Robert Shelley. I am an alcoholic.
Hi, Robert.
And so my sobriety date is February 2nd, 2018. But I've been coming to AA for a very long time. I started coming to AA in the early 80s. So it took me 35 years to kind of figure this out a little bit. I started drinking, and my story starts off typically just about like a lot of people. You know, I started drinking early, probably 12 or 13 years old. It was just me and my mom. I never met him, actually. It was just my mom and me raised me, no brothers, no sisters, none of that. There was no alcohol in the house, like as far as my mom didn't drink. She had alcohol, which I helped her with that, but it ended up being colored water before it was all said and done. But I remember my first drunk. You know, it was Thunderbird at a local. A few of you know that one, huh? Yeah, it was at a little comic book store that was out there in El Cajon. And I drank till I got sick. That was my first real drunk. And, you know, most normal people, that would be enough, and they'd be done at least for a while or something. But not me. The next day, I went out and did it again. And that became a pattern for me. That's what started all off. And I'm an alcoholic plus, so I'm an alcoholic plus anything else I could get my hands on most of my life. It never just stopped with just alcohol. But I started going to AA in 84, somewhere right around there, maybe 83, 84. My best friend's mom, she was one of us, and she's like, "You're one of us, you're coming with me." And so she dragged me to an AA meeting. I mean, I went willingly, but she took me to an AA meeting, and it was my first one out in Santee. And I kind of felt like I fit in. I wasn't really wanting to get, you know, sober at that time. But I went, you know, and I kind of messed around with it a little bit and went to some meetings down here. My first sponsor, he's dead now, but his name was Ted Howell. Some of you might have known him. He used to do the tapings for Clancy back in the way back when, you know. But that was my first sponsor. And I'd go to AA meetings drunk, and we went to the convention, and my homeboy rolled up with a keg in the back of his truck, and we were getting tore up at the AA convention. I guess that's what we did back then. My life is kind of a mess. Like I said, I alcohol and drugs, they weren't really my main problem. I was my main problem. And I was highly selfish and self-centered, and I really didn't care about anybody but myself most of my life. I got into a lot of trouble. I'll tell you about, I didn't do too bad till about high school. I got in a little bit of trouble before then, but by the time I got into high school, I went to high school and got kicked out of the high school. They put me in a little in-school continuation. Got kicked out of there, ended up at a continuation school called Chaparral. Got kicked out of there, and they put me into a probationary school called Summit. Then they got kicked me out of there, but they accepted me back at Chaparral at some kind of night school thing, and then finally got expelled permanently from the Grossmont School District. That's my ninth grade year. It took about half a year to do that. I can remember that day. They're like, "Mr. Shelley, you're permanently expelled." And I was like, "Yeah, you know, party time." So that was what that started that off. Started partying every day, hanging around with people. In the lifestyle that I lived, I hung around people like me. So, all the criminal behavior and the drugs and the alcohol and the whatever else that went with it, that whole lifestyle, I thought it was the normal for me. Finally, my mom got tired of my stuff at about 17, and she kicked me out of the house. She said, "You got to go. I can't deal with you anymore." you just got to go. So I got the bright idea, well, I'll join the Army, you know, she'll take me back then and I'll go join the Army. So I did. I went and joined the Army. Back then, you could go in when you were before, if you didn't have a high school diploma or whatever, they just did some kind of extra test and they let you in. So I joined the Army. That didn't work out very good. So I went through basic training. I was in like this cohort unit, but I got recycled because I had hurt my knees in the cohort unit. So I got stationed in Hawaii, and I remember telling them, you know, hey, you know, I smoke pot and I'm not going to stop smoking pot, and they're like, don't worry about it, everybody does. So I was like, okay, cool, you know. So I went to Hawaii, and the first UAs that came around, I was the only one in my whole battalion to come up dirty, so they gave me a field grade, bussed me back to E1, 45 days, you know, restriction, all that good stuff, So I did all that, got back on, and then the second UAs came around, and like half my battalion came up dirty, and they blamed it on me. They said I was selling them dope and all this stuff. And at that point, they put me on antabuse and everything else. They tried to put me in AA. I drank on the antabuse. I finally, the third UAs come around, and of course, I came up dirty again, and they asked me if I wanted out. And I told them yes. You know, they said we'll give you an honorable discharge, or you can go to a retraining brigade, and you can get out. And I said I'll take the honorable discharge. And so I got out, and that was I guess that was around 88, somewhere right around there. Came back to San Diego, started getting in trouble again. I got in trouble with the sheriff's department in Santee. They did not like me. I did not like them. I like to fight cops when I'm drunk, and among other things. So every time they'd see me, they'd put me in jail. So, you know, after like the 13th time of going to jail, I was like, I'm out of here. So I stole my friend's car, and I took off, you know, and left. And I just thought I'd leave San Diego. So that's when I left San Diego. I was like 19 years old. And so I left San Diego, and the party just got harder. You know, I started drinking a whole lot more, things like that. Ended up in Kansas, and at first it was cool. You know, when I got up there, you know, I mean, I was drinking every day, but I learned how to forge checks and some different things and loved to fight, go to the bars, all that kind of stuff. And at first the cops left me alone up there. They thought it was kind of cool, you know. They thought it was funny, you know, for a while until I beat one up. And then they didn't think it was funny anymore. And then I did it again, so now I'm going to the penitentiary. So I went to the penitentiary. That was my first trip in. I've been to the penitentiary 5 times in my life. I've been in a lot of trouble. I don't know how many jails, whatever. I like I said, I didn't care. Right before I went in, though, I did manage to have a son, you know, and I lost him when I went in. When I got out, actually, they his mom got found unfit because she was smoking crack and leaving him at the babysitter's house and all that stuff for days on end. And they decided to sever rights on both of us because we were unfit parents. So I got to see him right when I got out, but I'll get back to that in a minute. So I got out, you know, and it didn't take me long. Now, see, I'm the kind of person that the party never stops for me, you know, even inside the jails, inside the institutions, whatever, you know. I know how to make Pruno, and I know how to get what I want to get when I'm in there, you know, so it never stopped for me. I did my thing. So I got out of the penitentiary the first time, and I wasn't out very long, and got busted for some counterfeiting charges. And now keep in mind, during all this time, I'm going to AA. I still go to AA all the time. I don't know why I do it. Look, I'm the kind of person that gets drunk and will start reciting how it works to you, you know, while I'm drunk, you know. I want to tell people about AA. But anyway, so... But I also would, when I got out, I would never report to the parole officers either when I got out. So I got out of the penitentiary, and I was out for almost a year or so, and I got busted for a counterfeiting charge. And they were going to send me back to the penitentiary. This is the God shot. This is one of my first ones. pretty big one, but I've never talked in front of this many people before. I'm a little nervous. So anyway, so I get out, and they were talking like 15 to life or some crazy stuff like that. Well, I was hanging around with some pretty hardcore people, and I wrote my lawyer a letter and let him know that my friends would be happy to come and thank him for the wonderful job he was doing for me. Well, that worked, actually. So the next thing I know, I didn't even go back to the penitentiary. I went to some kind of community corrections facility. And but what I didn't know was that I think it was some kind of a divine appointment, because it was my first experience with God, like real experience with him. I went to like the self-hypnosis class. They put you in this treatment, and it's a couple of weeks of these different programs that they do. And this was some kind of self-hypnosis therapy session. So I went in there, and he had me do all the relaxation things and all this kind of different thing. And I'm laying there, and I saw like a vision in my head. And it looked like a guy in a robe, no color or anything, but it kind of had his own light. And he told me, love heals all things, but beware of false love. Right? And I thought it sounded cool, okay, you know, and I told the therapist, you know, thought maybe it might impress him, you know, I just thought it was in my imagination, you know. I didn't really take any heed to it at that time. And I went on about my business, and of course it wasn't much longer, and I ended up back in the penitentiary, and again and again and again. But that message that I had gotten that day, you know, it kind of started bouncing around in my head, and you know, I don't know how to explain it, but, you know, that was something that took a long, it was like a seed that got planted in me. That'd be the best way to explain it. It was like a seed that got planted in me. You know, the next time God showed up, I'm going to kind of get on the God thing a little bit here. The next time God showed up, you know, I was getting ready to go. We had a little girl, my girlfriend and I, we had a little girl, and I was getting ready to go. She was colicky real bad, you know, and so I would take her for rides in the car, because it would calm her down, you know, and she'd go to sleep or whatever. So I was getting ready to go get some breakfast, and so we put the car seat in there, everything, you know, and got it ready for her, and she was going to go with me. And then at the last minute, I was like, you know what? No, baby, let's just keep her. I'm just going to go get the breakfast, and I'll be right back. So I took off to go get the breakfast. It's about a mile away. Hardee's back east is what they call it. And anyway, so I was making a left-hand turn, and this guy came through the red light at about 60 miles an hour, and he hit me head on. And he destroyed the whole side of that car. And had that baby been with me, had I taken her with me, my life would have took a big time different course that day. And not only that, but you know what? This guy hit me that hard, destroyed my car, put the engine in my lap, and I didn't have a bruise on me. So God showed up to me that day too, you know. And then, you know, back to the same thing, back to the drinking. I'd go to AA, try to get sober for a little while, start drinking. It always starts with alcohol with me, always, you know. I start drinking, and the next thing I know, I'm doing everything else too. I could not stay sober. And it's not because I didn't want to. I did want to stay sober at times, you know. When my son was born, I tried to stay sober. There were several, you know, things happen in your life that cause you to want to stay sober, but I couldn't do it. I could never stay sober for longer than 9 months. That was the longest I made it up until February 2nd of 2018. But so then some things happened. You know, I went back to the penitentiary again. And then it was then right after my fourth trip in, God showed up again. Now this time, this one's pretty cool, and I like to share this one with people. So what happened was I had absconded. Like I said, I don't report to the parole officers, none of that stuff. So I had absconded, and I had new felony charges, and I had taken off with this girl that I was with, and we had gone up to Fayetteville, and we're staying with some friends of hers or whatever. And so she ditches me and leaves me with her friends, and I was getting tired. I was getting tired of running and all this kind of stuff. And this is the place I had committed my last set of crimes at, by the way. And so I told her friends, I said, you know what, I'm just going to turn myself in the morning. I've had enough, you know. I'm going to go get myself straightened out. I can't do this anymore. And they're like, okay, you know, that's cool. We'll take you and drop you off in the morning. I said, cool. So then I went outside, and I had it out with God. I talked to him I yelled at him. He's out in the country, you know, and I yelled at him for, I don't know, a couple hours probably, you know, wore myself out. I told him everything, good, bad, and indifferent, you know, let him know what I thought. And finally, I just kind of leaned up against an old car, and I was like, you know what, it's your world, whatever, you can have it, you know, whatever you want from me. And I went in and I went to bed, and I didn't really think about it anymore that night. Well, the next day, I had her friends go take me to the parole office. Now, this is Fayetteville, okay, Arkansas. They have signs around the town that tell you that they got room for you in their jails. They don't play, you know what I mean? So I went and turned myself into the parole office, and the parole officer in there, he was, I pulled the worst one, Officer Tabor. He was known for being kind of a hard ass, but I sat down and I told him the truth. I told him everything was going on. And he's like, you know what? Don't even worry about it. He said, just go get a travel pass from Little Rock. Let's get your life back on straight. Let's get these checks taken care of, you know, all this kind of stuff. And let me go. Well, I'm tripping because this never happens in this area, you know, and I've got new felony charges too. I'm like, you know what? What's really going on here? But so now I have to walk back to the farmhouse because it's like 10 miles back to the farmhouse, and this was before cell phones were very popular, so I didn't have a phone to call the people with and to come get me and all that stuff. So I went back, and now remember, I have a belly full of AA, and I'm big on, you know, I do some things, you know, according to the program, even when I'm all messed up. So on my way back, I had to go past this car lot where I committed my crimes, you know, and I thought I'd go in there and make an amends to the guy where I committed my crimes, right? So I walked in there, and he was sitting at the desk in there, and I was like, hey, Jim, I said, you know, and I made an amends to him, you know, and instead of getting mad at me or anything like that, this guy was like, don't worry about it, Robert. We needed a new back door anyway. How are you doing? You want to go to lunch? All this kind of stuff. I was like, okay, so now I'm on top of the world. Like, this day is, like, unbelievably good, you know what I mean? Crazy good. So I declined on the lunch. You know, I was feeling a little shame and guilt, whatever. So I went back to the farmhouse, and I wasn't there 15 minutes, and my girlfriend called me. She's like, I'm sorry, would you please come get me and all this stuff? And I don't know if that was a blessing or not, but, you know, it was at the time anyway. So I went and I got her. And I borrowed their car, and I went and I got her. And her friends were like, well, we need to celebrate. This has been a crazy day. Let's celebrate. And they went and got some Chinese food and came back. You know, I'm all pumped up. I got to know, you know, I got to see what my fortune is. You know, they have little fortune cookies in there and stuff. And so I popped open the fortune cookie, and it wasn't a fortune. It said, it's been most interesting talking to you. So I don't know. That's a pretty serious God shot. But 2 weeks later, I went back to the penitentiary. Everything fell apart. Girlfriend left. But it was my last trip in. I think it was necessary. I had some things I needed to straighten out. Unfortunately, when I went back in this time, I've been in so many times. I had a reputation in there by now. I mean, and I had become institutionalized. I really didn't want to come out this last time. I had become somebody in there, I guess you could say. You know, I was a high-ranking member of a gang inside the prison. Violent, you know, the whole nine yards. And did a couple of years, and then finally got out, you know. And that was the last time I got out. That was December of 2005. And didn't change right away. You know, you would think that you would change after a God shot like that, but I didn't right away. But that message, love heals all things, you know, it kept bouncing around in my head. I started really trying to do the AA program. I would go for a while. I don't know how I didn't go back to prison, because I was like still doing the same thing. I mean, high speed chases, people spinning out on the freeways and kicking in doors, just the whole knife, you know. And I don't know how I didn't, but for the grace of God, you know, I did not go back to the penitentiary again. But I started going to church and going to AA and doing all the things. You know, I really tried this thing. I really tried. I did the steps to the best of my ability. I did all these things, you know, and I didn't get it. I really had come to the conclusion that I was that hopeless variety, you know, constitutionally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living, you know, because I couldn't do it. You know, I'd get it for a little while. But see, here's the problem is that I kept doing it for me. And I know a lot of people, they come into these rooms and they say, you got to do it for yourself and love yourself before you can love others and forgive yourself. Well, see, that's not my story, though. You know, that was never my story. That's what kept me coming back and getting messed up over and over again because I kept putting myself first. So anyway, that message kept bouncing around in my head. You know, love heals all things, but beware of false love. And some things happened, and God started moving in my life in a different direction. He started taking things from me, you know, a little bit at a time. That was back out in Arkansas at this time. And I had gotten married. I had a wife and all this stuff, and she was bipolar crazy. And I know everybody kept trying to tell me, you know, hey, you need to get away from her. You're never going to get sober when you're with her. But I insisted on doing it my way. I'm that one in a billion that can do this, you know, and whatever. So that didn't work out too well. But I ended up leaving. We left Arkansas after we lost everything and started coming back this way. I remember that I had found something in the Bible about love. You know, all this time that message was in my mind, and I wanted to know what love is. I had become convinced that this was a message from God. Whether it is or not, I don't know. I like to believe it is, you know, but I wanted to know what this love was and how it works, you know. So actually, I had found the solution. I found part of it in the Bible, actually. I wasn't, you know, like a Christian or anything at that time. I believed in God, but wasn't really, you know, going down that road yet. But I had taken my wife to the doctors for a lung biopsy, and there was a Bible sitting there, and I was bored, so I started thumbing through it. And I found this passage, and it said Christian love in it, you know, in the Bible. And it said 1 Corinthians 13. So I turned there, started reading it, and I knew that I had found what I was looking for. And so now I decided that I was going to write this self-help book, and I was just going to do all this crazy stuff with it, you know. And so I totally discounted the rest of the Bible at that time. I wasn't, you know, I just wanted to get rich quick and have money to get drunk and high or whatever. That really was my thinking, you know. But so that didn't work out too well. Ended up losing my job. I had a pretty good career. I was doing custom fiberglass work and cut off my thumb, put a steel rod through my foot, high and drunk and whatever else I was at that time. So that was, I began to lose everything, got kicked out of our house because I couldn't make the payments because, you know, alcohol and my lifestyle was more important than a roof over my head. So we decided to come out back to California, lost everything on the way out here. God, just one thing after another, God took it all away from us, including the mother-in-law, which was probably a good thing, because she was with us, and she was trouble. But anyway, she decided it was too much for us, you know, when we got stuck in Oklahoma City, so she called her sister to come get her, and we lost her. We finally made it out here, out to Victorville, made it out there, and at my wife's family's house. And as soon as we got out there, that she started cheating on me and was messing on with all kinds of other stuff. Not that I was innocent either, but, you know. So I left her and went to the river up there, homeless, which is where things started to really change. Ended up on the river up there for like 5 years. I found another girl up there to mess with that was getting a check and, you know, built the Taj Mahal. I had a 18-foot teepee with a loft and solar panels and making wax on the river, you know, and staying drunk and high. That was my life, you know. Go up on this corner and I hold a sign begging for money every day. That was my thing. And in this corner, you know, it had a big play in my life with the things to come. So I get up there and up there holding the sign and everything. So the next time, then that's about when God started showing up again. Things were getting kind of bad, you know. I mean, we were doing like a lot of dope. I was selling dope. I was drinking probably a handle a day or more. I don't know. You know, I mean, it's just that was my nourishment. I was barely eating. You know, I was dying. I had hit that place, you know, that a hopeless state of mind and body, you know, and things were kind of bad. And I didn't really want it to continue there. It wasn't, I mean, don't get me wrong, it wasn't all bad. It was, you know, there were good days out there, you know, but I don't really remember too many of them, but those were probably the better days. But anyway, so some things started happening, and I started thinking about that message again. This is kind of crazy. So this is, now we're at what happened, okay? So here's what happened to me, where I started getting it. I was up there on that corner, and I was holding a sign. And this dude pulls up in a truck, an old brown truck, and he's like, "Are you hungry?" And I was like, "Yeah." And he said, "Well, jump in, I'll take you to go get something to eat." And I was like, "Okay, you know." And normally I didn't do that kind of thing, you know. I take your money, but I'm not going to get anybody's vehicle. But I felt safe, so I jumped in the truck. And he's like, so he takes me over this bridge to Jack in the Box, and he gets me, he's like, "Get something to eat, get something for later," and he gives me all the money in his wallet. He said, "You need a jacket?" Winter was coming. I was like, "Yeah, I do need a jacket." So he hands me this brand new Carhartt jacket. Now look, you can see that I'm a big dude, right? And this jacket fit perfectly. Okay, so I don't know, and this guy was not that big. He was kind of a small guy, but he had a jacket that fit me, so that was cool. But it was what he told me when he dropped me off that meant everything. As he dropped me off, he asked me where some more homeless people were so he could go, you know, give some more clothes to them or whatever. And then when he dropped me off, he said, "You know, because you met me, your life is going to change." And he wasn't wrong. That was the beginning of the end. Some things happened after that. The next thing I know, I started thinking about that message a whole lot more. I started thinking that I'm going to turn my life over to God now. You know, okay, God, you win. I'm giving it to you, all this, you know. And I figured, I thought since I was going to give my life to God, that I could go up there on that corner and hold a sign and people would give me all this money so that I could go get my drugs and alcohol. It didn't work out that way. Actually, it went the other way. He cut me off completely. I could go hold a sign all day and maybe make a couple of dollars, if that. But somehow I always got fed. But I got mad. Now bear in mind, I told you I had an 18-foot teepee. You know, it had a loft, okay? So, you know, we'd sleep in the loft, especially in the wintertime, because we could build a fire. I had a rock fireplace, all this, you know, tweaker stuff. But so we could sleep in the loft, you know. It would stay warm up there, you know. So I got mad at God. I went up there one day, and I just had enough. And I got mad at him, and I was like, you know what, whatever. And I figured he just was messing with me or something. And so I did what any childish, immature, you know, drunk would do. I went to my teepee, and I hung myself. And I tried to take my life. I should not be standing here today. I tied the rope to the beam that was like the main support beam for the loft. I mean, like, I could do pull-ups on that beam, and it was fine, you know. My girlfriend was asleep on the couch. I didn't say anything to her. I just shook my fist at God, tied the rope up there, and I hung myself. I lost consciousness. I went out, and then all of a sudden I came to, and I was on the ground. I didn't come away unscathed. I'd fallen on a pail and busted some ribs in my back. And came up confused, angry, didn't know what had just happened, mad at God. And so and then my girlfriend woke up at that time, and she gave me comfort that day. It was probably the first time she ever had compassion on me. But, you know, I remember looking at the nails and the boards and stuff and thinking, how could this possibly have come down like that? But it did, and the nails, they had pulled out like perfectly straight. You know, it shouldn't have happened. I should be dead, but I'm not. So I got up, and then about 2 weeks later, not even 2 weeks, probably about a week later, I still was like all funky in my head and depressed, and because things weren't working out the way I thought they should work out. Now remember, I held a lot of signs. You know, I would make all these signs. My camp was littered with them everywhere, hundreds and hundreds of these signs that we'd make and then go hold them on the corner. And not always would I make signs begging for money. Sometimes I'd make signs just to, for whatever. One of them said, "God bless, smile if you love God," you know. Anyway, so I'm sitting in my teepee on a couch and all depressed and thinking about doing it again. Okay, this time I'll jump off the cliffs or step in front of a train or something. You know, we'll do it right this time. You know, that didn't work. So I'm sitting there on the couch and this sign that I had made, it said "God bless" at the top, "smile if you love God." It had gotten folded and trampled and found its way up to eye level with me sitting on the couch. And now it said something else entirely. It said "God" at the top, and then it said "smile, you go." So I thought that was like another one, you know, another God shot. And I took that as literal, you know. He's telling me to get up and get out, you know, start doing something, do something with your life. And so I did. Not right away. I mean, I started changing. I started like preaching to all my people that I was homeless with. And I would even give them drugs. You know, I'd go give them half my drugs or whatever. I didn't know. You know, I was pretty shot out at this point. And right about that time, at the same time, you know, God gave me a Bible. I mean, actually three of them, you know, which was kind of crazy. I'm up there on that same corner, you know, and then remember, this is a big homeless. We would take turns signing. There's a lot of homeless in that area. You guys know the scene. You see it all over San Diego. And these homeless people will take anything that looks like it's value. It doesn't even have to be a value, though. It's trash, and they think it's valuable, and they'll take it and take it to their camp. Well, anyway, there's a book sitting on a little electric thing up there by the corner where I was sitting there. And it sat there for like 2 weeks, and nobody touched it. Brand new in the package, and it just sat there. Finally, I'm like, you know what? This must be for me. So I went over there, and it was a brand new Bible in the package, you know, brand spanking new. It was like with pictures and everything. So that was the first one. The second one, the next day I was up in the hills kind of hiking around. You know, I just like to hike up in the hills in there, and I come across the second one, you know, and it wasn't brand new, but it was like bookstore new, you know, out of a used bookstore type thing. And it was some kind of study Bible. Saw that one. And then my girlfriend, she liked to dig in the trash cans. She brought me one back that night. So that was three in 2 days. You know, I'm thinking, oh, okay, so I guess he wants me to read the Bible. So I started reading the Bible and studying it at that point. Then a few weeks later is when it happened. I don't know how to explain this. I'll tell you about it real quick, though. But so I got back up on the corner. So up to this point, I was still like super selfish and self-centered, you know. It's all about me, you know, obviously with the hanging and all that stuff. I got back up on that corner and I was just sitting there. I wasn't making any money or anything, but I started thinking about, you know, all the people that I had hurt in my life, which is a pretty extensive list. You know, I did a lot of damage everywhere I went. I was just a tornado of damage to everything and everybody around me. I started thinking about all that damage that I had done to people. And for the first time in my life, I started thinking about it as if I was them, okay? So AA did some things. It put some seeds in me, for sure, you know? So I was up there, and I was thinking about all these different things that I had done to the people and the harm that I'd caused them, and what if that was me, and the offense that I had given to God himself, you know? And the tears just came. I'll never forget it. And I was so I had to get away from that corner. I didn't want people to see with me because I couldn't stop crying. I mean, I don't think I've ever really cried that hard before. And so there was like a mortuary back behind there, and it went into the desert. And I went back there into the desert and fell down on my knees and just begged for forgiveness and told him I was so sorry about all the pain and hurt that I had caused these people in my life and him, and that I was willing to make it right. And I would do whatever he wanted me to do to make it right. And this pain that I felt, this sadness that was in me, these tears that came down, they turned from sadness and pain to joy as I felt his forgiveness for the first time in my life. I don't know how to explain anything like that to anybody. in here if you haven't ever experienced anything like that. But, you know, that's why I don't like that. You got to forgive yourself before you can forgive others. I never could forgive myself. It's not something I was capable of doing. But I can tell you that when God forgave me, I knew I was forgiven. And so that's where that's at with that. Anyway, so it didn't stop there. You know, I don't know if I want to get into this next part or not, but it didn't stop there. But so after I finally gained my composure, I told God, I said, you know what? Just if you'll let me go home, if you'll make it, because my mom and me were not getting along at this time. We never had gotten along again after when she kicked me out when I was 17. We'd talk, and she was there a little bit, but I never was able to fix that, make amends to her like that. So I told God, I said, you know what, if you'll just make it so I can go home for a week, you know, I'll walk away from all of it, the drugs, the alcohol, everything, you know, the women, the cigarettes, the whole nine, I'm done with all of that. So I regained my composure. Now I had to go find a cell phone, you know, I was going to live up to it. So I took off and went to go find a cell phone. And as I was getting ready to go across the street to where the cell phone was, I remember these cops pulled me over. And I don't know why I'm even bringing this up, except for it was kind of weird. Because it was like they were from the 60s or something. I don't know, big black cop and a little white cop, and it was some weird thing. But so they pulled me over. They didn't ask my name. They didn't ask for ID. Nothing. They just wanted to know where I was going and what I was doing. I told him. He said, "Well, you sit down right there." He said, "If you move, I'm going to shoot you." I assured him I wasn't going to move. And then so he went and he talked to his buddy for a minute. He comes back. He says, "You make sure you go call your mom." And they left. Like, okay, you know, whatever. So I went and I called my mom. She could barely understand me because I'm in tears, you know. "Mom, I need to come home. I'm, you know, blah, blah, blah." So she agreed. So she let me come home. So I was going to be good to my word. I was going to go hitchhike home the next day. So I take off and, or actually I was going to come hitchhike home that night. I didn't even tell my girlfriend or anybody. I was going to go straight to on-ramp and hitchhike at home. And I made it up there. Nothing happened. It was getting dark and getting late, and so I figured I better go home and tell my girlfriend I'm going to be leaving for a week, you know, and I'll come back in the morning and it'll be okay, you know. I kind of felt that way, and so I did. I went back and told her I was leaving. She wasn't too happy, but, you know, we talked a little bit, and the next morning I went up there to go home, and I stopped and got a coffee at the AMPM right there and went up on the corner. I didn't even make it through my coffee. My coffee in the sheriff's department come pulling up. And this time they ran my name, though. And I did have a warrant, but they weren't tripping. He's like, "You know what, we're going to buy you a bus ticket home." And I said, "Well, you know," and I know that they do that sometimes. They'll buy it to get you out of their area or whatever. And I told him, I said, "You know, I'm coming back in a week." He said, "Well, still, you know, you don't need to be hitchhiking." So they bought me a bus ticket. And but I had to wait till that night. So I went and waited till that night for the bus to come, and the bus finally got there. It was like way late, and there was like a long line of people. There was all the seats were filled but one, and it was this dude that was drunk in his seat and had a beer in his in backpack in my seat. And I moved his stuff on him and sat down, and we started our journey. And that's when things got really weird. Now, this is the day after, you know, that I had I guess you'd call it repent or whatever you want to call it. Up out in the desert, and we started this bus ride home, and it was kind of crazy because I could hear, I don't know, my hearing like got really acute. I could hear everybody talking on the bus, all this ghetto talk and whatever, and it was like really bugging me. It was getting loud, and it was like I wanted it. I was like, "Man, God, do something. This is like going to drive me crazy," and it did. It got kind of calm in there. It got kind of peaceful over the bus, and then it was like every conversation on that bus, everybody's voice kind of melded into one voice that I could hear with my ears, and I had a conversation with something, which I think it was Christ. I don't know. I believe that. Whatever it was, it never told me, but I did have a conversation, and it was talking about love, you know, and it wanted me to have this character of love and to be him in a way. And I didn't understand it at the time. It was scary. I was scared. you know, to have a conversation with something you don't understand like that. But and then when the conversation was over, I fell asleep, made it back to San Diego. I went to my mom's, and I made it 3 days without the cigarettes, and I made it the whole week without any alcohol or drugs. I wasn't in really good shape, and I couldn't wait to get out of my mom's house so I could get back up to Victorville and get me something to drink and put something in me. And so that's what I did. And I made it back up there, and then as soon as I got up there, it was about a week later, and my girlfriend that I had up there, and she was mad that I left and destroyed my pot plants and everything and whatever, so I had to make them all into wax or whatever. But anyway, so it was like 2 weeks up there, and she collapsed. We were leaving the camp. It was like a half a mile from anything, and she collapsed and had a heart attack. And so I got the 911, got the ambulance out there, and they took her to the hospital. And because I didn't make it there that night, she had a fit, and they had to put an emergency stent in her, and she bailed from the recovery room. She didn't even stay, and comes walking back into the camp the next morning, and like nothing had happened. She didn't care that it did. Like, who does this? You know, you're crazy. So she didn't get none of her medicine. You're supposed to take this stuff called Plavix when they do that kind of thing, and she didn't take any of that. So a week later, she had another one, and this time it was at the camp, and she refused to go to the hospital. I even called, you know, the fire and rescue out there, and they're the only ones that could get out to where we were camped at, and she refused to go to the hospital, none of that. And I remember, so they left. They were like, because she knows her name and what year it is, they could do nothing about it if she doesn't want it done. So she stayed. So I was out of options. I went through 3 days with her. It was the hardest 3 days of my life, easily some of the darkest I've ever been through, because she would scream and scream and scream and clutch her chest until she passed out. You know, I would think she was dead. You know, a couple times I thought about helping her out a little bit. but I didn't, you know, and after 3 days of this, I didn't know what else to do. So finally, I went down to the, you know, I'd read something in the Bible about getting clean. I probably took it out of context, but I went down to the river and got cleaned up and then prayed to God really hard. And then came back in there, and it was another one where it was just like an hour of yelling at him kind of thing. And then I went into the tent, and I just held her and said a quick prayer. And that night she was out cutting wood, like she was healed. She totally took a reversal on that, and it did something to me. You know, at this point, these things had added up, and this is my whole point. I was getting to this, is that, you know, the love for others. Because, see, something had changed in me, something fundamental that kept me from getting sober all those years, is because the only thing I was ever looking at was myself. I couldn't look at the people around me. You know, when I read the big book of AA and I look at these steps and I work these steps, you know, if you go to chapter 12 in the big book, you know, and something I don't hear people talk about too much, you know, it tells you in there to let your sponsee know that to put the welfare of other people ahead of your own. You know, we don't do that anymore. We're so selfie-centered these days, it's crazy, you know. So I often wonder, what's wrong with AA? You know, if I'm reading this correctly, you know, we're talking about 75% of the people in that were coming to the program back then were staying sober. And now it's what, maybe less than 10%? You know, what's going on, you know, and I wanted to do something about it, and it's about the love. That's what it is. You know what, the principle behind these steps that I have found is love. It's about, you know, the book tells us, it says, nothing will ensure our sobriety more than intensive work with another alcoholic. Well, you know what, there's some things I learned about love, and I'll close with these. I just want to tell you real quick about that. You know, I found that there's three components to love that make up love, building blocks, if you want to call it like that. You know, most of us know about sentiment. Most of us think about love as a sentiment, you know, a feeling. Well, that's cool. That is part of it, you know, and it's an important part. But there's a couple of other parts that are even more important, and one of them is commitment, okay? So you can't have sentiment without commitment. If you're committed to something, you're going to have feelings about it. If you have feelings about something, you're going to be committed to it to some degree or another. So those two come hand in hand. But see, the difference is that you can choose what you want to be committed to. You can't choose how you feel about something, but you can influence it by what you commit your life to. So there's that. But then, let's go back to 1 Corinthians 13, because then there's another kind of love that I found that is the greatest love. See, the God I serve is love, okay? And so the love that we are is the most important love. And that's about our character, who we are as people. And what this program teaches us, you want healing? You know, I'll go back to love heals all things, but beware of false love. I can prove it to you right now. Let's take 100 people that are living in a hopeless state of mind and body, that are dying from this disease, and they're selfish and self-centered and not giving any kind of anything, how long would they last? You know, the first 100 people of AA, if Bill and Bob hadn't come along with this program, how long would they last? You know, they would have been dead within a few years, you know, if they're lucky to live that long. But here comes Bill and Bob, and they teach them some principles that have love in it. They teach them how to clean house, you know, change our character, change the way that we think, put the welfare and well-being of other people ahead of our own. You know, that's what love is. And when we do that, we start healing. So it does heal all things. It certainly heals some alcoholics, and it certainly healed me, you know, because I know I was of the hopeless variety. I really just barely touched some of the things. Trust me, I was a messed up individual, but you know, that's all I really wanted to share with you today. You know, if you don't get anything out of there, if you really want to heal, get out of yourself. You know, let me tell you, another thing I've learned is this selfishness and self-centered. The book says is it'll kill us. You know, and if you think about it, all the bad things that we have, the guilt, the shame, the remorse, the fear, the anxiety, all these things are tied to what? To ourself. So what's the answer? Get out of yourself. Get out of yourself and those things go away. They no longer have power over us anymore. Anyway, my name is Robert, and that's my story. Thank you.